Well, hello again, everyone. We are continuing with Andre Siegfried's The Character of Peoples. And we have finally reached the final, or the penultimate chapter, I should say, the last chapter focusing on a specific group. And that group is the Americans. This should be very interesting. Here we are. The chapter is called American Dynamism. And then we have a final long chapter on the destiny of Western civilization. If you haven't been following this series, this book was written in 1952. He's had all sorts of interesting insights so far into the Latin Europeans, the French, the English, or the British, the Germans, who he wasn't very nice about, the Russians, who I also say he wasn't very nice about, to be honest, and now the Americans. It's a promising chapter heading. Sounds like he is going to be nice about the Americans, but let's see. He is a snooty Frenchman, of course. Just before we get, and when I say that, I mean it in the best possible way. I've kind of enjoyed his undeniable French arrogance. He's got that kind of Gallic shrug about him, you know, shades of Ginola and Cantona and these sorts of French characters. I remember from football when I was growing up. But anyway, if you want to pick up a course at the academic agency, it's the Trivium, best-selling course there. You can also pick up the latest course, Foundations of Shakespeare, buy it now. That has sold pretty well too. Many other courses available. So pick those up, but let's not waste any further time because it's a good 20 pages to get through. He says, the American people, having become the most important section of the Anglo-Saxon world, now represents one of the dominating elements in the white race. In addition, it is coming forward more and more as one of the leaders and, above all, the guarantor of our threatened Western civilization. Again, the system, the American World Order, Pax Americana, was just being put together in 1952, right? So the band was being put together. The transition from the British Empire to the American Empire was happening here. Now, as I record this in 2025, under Trump 2.0, it's rapidly being dismantled, of course, with various world leaders declaring that world order that he's talking about is over as I record this. So kind of interesting. But anyway, let's carry on. Certainly all of my life so far, this description has been true of America basically being the guarantor of what we call Western civilization, for better or for worse, because, well, as people will know, I've got my own thoughts on, you know, what Americanization has done to the quote-unquote West. But anyway, there is nothing astonishing in this development, because America's contribution to human progress in the past 300 years has been outstanding. Not only is the United States the most authentic expression of our mechanical age, but modern democracy cannot be understood without having regard to the form it has taken there. And at the same time, the material equipment of the world is being refashioned on the American model. The structure of this really new civilization is the result of complex factors. First of all, there is the geographical factor in a separate and distinct continent where nature herself has a different aspect to the one with which we are familiar. Then there is the ethnic factor. A new human unity has resulted from a fusion of elements from all the races in Europe in the American melting pot. And finally, there is the fact of quite recent origin, that the United States has become a world power almost abruptly and without a transitional stage. Its rapid development is not yet at an end, and we have the impression of something still in process of evolution and changing from decade to decade under the eyes of the observer. It is not a country of definite and fixed qualities, and we have continually to revise our definitions. As a faithful discipline of our, Madame de la Pasille, the apostle of the obvious, let me begin by pointing out that the United States is in the New World, and that this New World really is new. Unless we approach the problem from its continental aspect, never forgetting the fact that America is not Europe, we shall fall into constant error. The first thing which strikes the observer is the grandeur of nature, which seems to have been conceived on quite a different plane from nature in Europe. The Niagara Falls, the Mississippi, the Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains, all prominent geographical aspects of the New World, cannot be compared with our European geographical structure. They are more related to the vast continents of Africa and Asia, and even to Russia, whose elementary proportions have been described to us so strikingly by Luc d'Urtain. We must never overlook the impressive contrast between American massivity and European articulation. On one coast, the continent is without capes or bays, and the ocean penetrates nowhere. On the map, it looks like a solid wall. On the other side, there is a subtle articulation which carries the maritime atmosphere right into the heart of the continent, whilst at the same time the coastline sends out audacious capes right into the heart of the ocean, no longer a wall, but a serrated edge with long fingers. The result of all these factors is a special interplay of relations between man and nature in America. Man has effectively conquered nature, and the victory is astounding, but it cannot be said that man has adapted himself. To listen to him, you would think the laws of development and maturity were not made for him. America positively boasts that she has no peasants, and that is quite true, but she also has no peasant wisdom. Men ignore the limitations imposed by the climate and by the capacities of the soil. They are not prepared to take them into account. They are convinced that they can impose their will on nature and force her to give what conditions will not allow her to give. It is true that up to now nature has lent herself to such pretensions with extraordinary generosity, a generosity which is only now beginning to flag. Despite certain signs of precocious ageing, we are struck by the youthful resources of a continent which has virgin soil but recently, and we are tempted to quote Le Brure, who says, "Jeunesse du prince, source de belles fortunes." We are also astonished at the extent of the territory which is at the disposal of man. The result of this is an attitude towards land which bears no relation to ours. Hence a policy which is so different from ours that the misunderstanding on the point between Europeans and Americans becomes permanent. These territories are not disputed. No one dreams of disputing them so long as there is ample quantity for all. Seize Canada. Seize Mexico. Found a colony. Such ideas are perfectly clear and understandable to us, but to Americans they mean nothing. The Americans have no sense of territorial conquest. If they quote-unquote take anything, and of course they do, just as everyone else does, it is not by territorial annexation, by extending their own frontiers, but by financial, industrial, and commercial ascendancy. Annexation, properly so called, does not interest them. The conditions of production offer the same striking contrast. In this country, still economically young, where nature provides all one could wish for, it is paradoxically easier to create wealth than share existing wealth. That is just the opposite of the situation in our tired old Europe, where nature does not place the same resources at our disposal, and where, in consequence, it is easier to share than to produce. The result is readily observable. Where the European has become a revolutionary, putting the accent on sharing, the American has remained conservative, thinking of production first. The comparison is one between two continents. Perhaps it would even be more accurate to say that it is between two ages, youth on one side and maturity, if not age, on the other. The traits which the American owes to the fact that he lives in the New World, a world which really is new, are impressive. The most astonishing thing to us is his congenital optimism, which has hardly been shaken by the participation of the United States in the recent tribulations of the world. Every American has an innate confidence in the future, in his future, and in the future of his continent. We in Europe once had a similar faith in our destiny, but that was 100 years ago, in the middle of the roaring 19th century, and we have lost it, or at least we had lost it. When we go to the United States, if not perhaps in times of crisis, then in times of prosperity, 1925 and 1945, yet despite or perhaps even because of the war, then we find once again that atmosphere of triumphant dynamism, the conviction that man is all-powerful, that there is nothing impossible in the face of his energy and his will. It is the pride of the pioneer who opened up a continent. It is also the spiritual liberty of men who believe that the future is theirs and who do not feel themselves the prisoners of the past. But perhaps America has reached a turning point. Already the fact that she has ignored certain laws of nature, for instance with regard to soil erosion, has compelled her to correct certain of her previous habits. There is no doubt that nature can be forced for a time, and even her rhythm can be changed. But can it be done indefinitely? The end result is still unknown. To borrow a phrase of Paul Valéry, it is a great venture. The question such a venture raises is whether man can dissociate himself from the laws of nature. It is easy to see that the conditions required for a real understanding of a country when one is a European are not simple. First of all, we must realize clearly that America's development is still proceeding at a rapid pace. The American himself is not fixed, a fixed entity, either physically, because the propulsion continues to be affected by a fusion with disparate elements, or geographically, because from the immigration, the American will still retains an element of nomadism, which is an interesting Carlyle phrase, nomadism, or socially, because he is unstable and unsettled in his occupations. You know, I once read a stat that the average European in his lifetime will move only 4 times, whereas the average American will move 11 times. And when Americans move, they're not just moving like locally, they could be moving to a different state, which is like moving to a different country, right? So Americans are more mobile. They are more nomadic in their ways. They never kind of fully settle down. And this is a real big contrast, I think, between the British and the American mindset. The British mindset is always in the shire, right, where Americans love to move around. This is something I found, not just looking at stats like that, but actually having met Americans and been to America and met loads of Brits, obviously. This is a real difference between the two people, in my opinion. And it's interesting to see Siegfried pick up on nomadism as a feature of the psyche. So the geographical aspect or in his social aspect, because he is unstable and unsettled in his occupations. We must also try to acquire a sense, to some extent physical, of the American continent. And we must realize that its measurements are not ours, and that its climate is foreign to us, that its colors, its smells, and its tempo are different to ours. Its contours are different to ours. We must realize that the tempo of life, swift with men of slow temperament, is specific there. And finally, that the moral climate is not the same at all as the moral climate of Europe. To cross the Atlantic is to remove oneself from one's normal ambient, not only nationally, but also continentally. In fact, in speaking of that new world, we must even change our vocabulary, because words take on a different sense there. And if we refuse to make the change, the result will be ceaseless misunderstandings. Where Russia was concerned, we were no longer in the West, but at a pinch, we were still in Europe. In America, we are still in the West, but we are no longer in Europe. And this is something which must never be forgotten. And I have to say, having traveled, I mentioned before, I've driven Route 66 from Chicago all the way to LA. And I've also traveled extensively in the East Coast of America. I've been all around America, over the course of my life. And the landscape is so different from the landscape here. If you've been to Texas, I mean, you can look in Texas now, you can look and not see the end of the land, okay? The horizon, like where the floor and the sky meet, that just doesn't exist in this country, right? I remember seeing, going into Texas, there were these three chairs that had been parched in the sun. And it's like, well, maybe nobody had seen these chairs in years. And there was one, like the sun was baking in the sky and it had that kind of like almost deserty scrubland, you know, that. And one of those, things that you see in cartoons come across the, I forget what they're called now, like the dust, like where we're so quiet that the dust thing goes across the road. I mean, seriously, it's such a different place. And on that drive, you know, even going from state to state was stark. Like Arizona is so, like some of those areas, it's like nothing you'll see in this country and nothing you'll see in Europe as well. It is a completely different landscape. And it's, you can't get away from it. This is also true up in the Northeast, where, like, if you go up by Boston and places like that, the color of the trees, the type of trees that they have there, it's hard to explain, but it's so different from this country and from Europe. So I don't want to ramble on too much, but this point by Siegfried is undeniable, I think. Whether you're from America or from Europe. Anyways, let's carry on. The populating of the United States by an immigration, largely European, was beyond all doubt one of the fundamental events in world history. This massive movement of human beings involved vastly greater numbers than did the barbarian invasions of the 5th century. Few people realize that between 1815 and 1914, 40 million people left the old continent, and that more than 30 million of them went to North America. The result of this immense ethnic migration was nothing less than the birth of a new section of the white race. The elements involved came from the older races, but their transplantation turned them into a new people, and their assimilation has made them unrecognizable. It should be added that the great flow carried with it not only whites, but also Negroes and men of yellow skin, and that there was also the pre-existing race of the native Indians. This has given rise to problems of racial contact, which have no parallel in Europe, though perhaps to some extent in the European colonies. The ethnic atmosphere of the United States is exotic and, in a certain degree, colonial. And this is something else I've tried to stress before, that these the immigration problems of Europe now really do feel like a transplantation of quote-unquote American racial issues being imported here or imported into France or elsewhere. And it's notable that this has happened in the American moment. It happened as part of Pax Americana, okay? And this is something else that I think is not fully understood. when sometimes you get critiques from Europeans or from Brits talking about this, you know, so many times on a show like Lotus Eaters, they've talked about race as a kind of American, like an American, like just an American issue, really, that we didn't have here even 20, 30 years ago, okay, or even 10 years ago. Anyway, I'll continue. Three main waves of immigration can be distinguished in the makeup of the American people, which results entirely from transplantation. The first wave was in the 17th and 18th centuries and represented an English Protestant colonization, which gave rise to the Puritans of New England, the Quakers of Philadelphia, and a very different type, the planters of the South, aristocrats and Anglicans, and the possessors of slaves. From these initial elements, a basic population formed. It was not affected to any noticeable degree by the presence of a few Dutchmen and Germans. The first formation has remained decisive, and it should not be forgotten that its origins were not industrial, and that its ancestors brought with them all the individual qualities of energy and asceticism which characterized pioneering stock. The second wave flowed into the country in the 19th century, between 1840 and 1880, bringing with it about 10 million souls. These newcomers had left their own countries largely in order to escape famine, revolution, and persecution, which were rampant in Europe at that time. Very often it was the vanquished who came to the New World to seek a new life, one which would allow them to live in freedom, freedom to live their own lives, freedom to work, and freedom to hold their own political convictions. Once again, there were English and Scottish elements, but the wave now included great numbers of Germans, Irish, Scandinavians, and Jews. As a result, the United States tended to become less anglicized whilst remaining fundamentally Anglo-Saxon. The country was affected by German seriousness with their Germanic taste for system and regimentation. Two other ferments were at work at the same time. The Irish, who captured municipalities in the big towns, were Catholics, and they introduced a certain element of devilment and charm, which is typically Celtic, and an element of fantasy, blarney and disorder, without which the Puritan atmosphere would have become intolerable. And then there were the Jews, who brought in their relentlessness, their curiosity, their hectic pursuit of wealth and of ideas, and their erratic rhythm and source of disorder. Just as the German influence made the United States a less exclusively English country, so too these two new influences made it less exclusively Protestant. A new America began to take shape, quite different from the first, and very different, as we soon shall see, from the third America, which was to follow it. Le Outre-mer of Bourget and Le Transatlantique of Abel Hermant illustrated this phase of US history. The third wave began in 1880 and went on until 1914. It was bigger and more important than the second, and it brought no less than 22 million souls into the country. And, make a special note of it, these elements were no longer Anglo-Saxon, but of Slavo-Latins. Mediterranean and Eastern European elements represented 70% of the total. The human beings who came into the country at this time were very different from their predecessors. The attraction which drew this great mass of human beings towards the United States was the high wages to be earned there. They were urged on by the desire to escape from the low standards of living which prevailed in the less developed parts of the old continent from which they came. It should be noted, too, that this was an organized immigration arranged either by the steamship companies or by special emigration societies. and to that extent there was a certain element of passivity about it. The newcomers were primarily poor people, most of them Catholics. They piled into the cheaper quarters of the big towns, too slow in their reactions to assimilate themselves. In this way, the old population did not lose its character, but was increased in numbers by decidedly heterogeneous elements. It was then that a problem arose in all its ramifications, one which America already knew, but which now became more acute. The problem of assimilating these immigrants, who had been introduced into American life in large batches. Three generations are necessary for the completion of the process. The first immigrant remains throughout his life a man of his own country of origin. He may learn to speak English, and of course, though he does not always do so, but if he does speak it, he speaks it with an accent. He may also dress like an American and try to live like an American, but one can see a long way off that he is not an American. His sons are different. They are educated at the local elementary schools and they speak only English. They are already more than half assimilated by their environment. If they are aware of their origin, they are rarely inclined to boast of it. They are more likely to look down on their parents and to repeat the denial of St. Peter. Their children, the third generation, are then totally assimilated. Even the memory of their European origin fades. The name has often become anglicized, and more than one Catholic or Jew has become a Methodist or an Anglican. If the type cannot become physically Anglo-Saxon, the manner is nevertheless now authentically American. And if some residue remains deep down, which has not been exercised by the fusion, it is merely a question of nuances visible only to penetrating analysis. Are we therefore entitled to say that America has assimilated the immigrants in her melting pot? To what extent has she really made these Italians, these Russians, these Balkans, these Germans proper Americans? If it is a question of appearances, then she has certainly succeeded. There is, in an American way of speaking, feeling, acting, discussing and behaving, and it is just as much found in the descendants of the last wave of emigrants as in the descendants of the 100% founders of the country. However, the influence of exotic elements is still great, particularly in the big cities of the Atlantic seaboard, the unloading points of the mass immigration. New York does not give the visitor the impression of a homogeneous and well-balanced population. The mass of people moving along Broadway and Fifth Avenue contains not only whites, but many Negroes, yellow-skinned people, and mixtures which cannot be classified by the colours of their skin. And if one looks at the names over the shops, then those of non-Anglo-Saxon origin, Italian, Hungarian, Balkan, or Russian, greatly outnumber the others. By contrast, the German names, which one sees everywhere, begin to appear almost native. Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago, and San Francisco all offer a replica of the spectacle provided by the streets of New York. But these big cosmopolitan towns, centres of assimilation, are not the whole country. They are not even the ethnic axis of the country. That axis remains Anglo-Saxon, though if there is still an Anglo-Saxon majority, it must have become very narrow. I think it's something like 20%. Don't quote me on that, but last time I looked, I think it's about 20% these days. When he was writing, maybe it was more like 30, 35, 40%. Although I do have a book here called The Dispossessed Majority. I can't remember the writer now, which argues that it may have even been smaller back then as well. Anyway, if you look at an American crowd or at a group of Americans, you are struck by the fact that physically the various types are strangely different. There are blondes, browns and chestnuts, blue eyes and dark eyes, fair complexions and dark complexions. Dolly Trochiphalix and Brachiocephalix, tall, well-made people and short people. There can certainly be no question of any American race. But is there at least an American people? Let us examine the question. And if anybody can answer this question, it will be Siegfried, won't it? Because he's gone through all the other peoples of Europe as well. So let's see. Can one really say that there is an American people as there is a French or an English or a German people? Or to approach the problem from another angle, is it possible to define an American psychology? So far, we have spread out the most varied and singularly disparate elements for examination. Let us now ask ourselves whether these elements, stirred together in the famous melting pot, have ended up by constituting a specific individuality. Assimilation, from the standpoint of the descendant of the old Puritans, means turning the immigrant into an Anglo-Saxon. Israel Zwangville conceived the operation in a larger and more mystical spirit. And this is a quote from Zwangville. America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all the races of Europe are melting and reforming. The real American has not yet arrived. He is only in the crucible. This is Siegfried again. Has he arrived yet? And if he has, does he conform to the narrow conception of Protestant nationalism or to the larger conception of the idealistic Jew? The question arises today in quite a different fashion. It's funny, isn't it? Because that is still being debated now, right? All over my timeline, I see basically a rearticulation of those two visions of America. I guess you'd call it Protestant nationalism and the idealistic Jewish vision. Those are frequently contrasted in today's politics because American nationalism is a live question under Donald Trump today. The question arises today in quite a different fashion. But since the end of the 19th century, there has been a complete transformation of American society involving not only the cosmopolitan and nature of the people, but also the economic and technical conditions in which they live. The Industrial Revolution, the introduction of the mechanical age born of the steam engine, has revealed all its consequences only during the past half a century. And it is in the United States in particular that these consequences have been most profound and most revolutionary. The turning point seems to have been the First World War. The curious thing is that the making of the American people was further advanced at the end of the 19th century than it is today. I have been in a position to make the comparison, and after 1918, I was definitely impressed by a feeling that something had started up again, that it was not only a question of development, but of the birth of a new civilization, a civilization which did not develop from the former one, but had its roots elsewhere. It is from this standpoint that we must examine the America of today if we hope to understand her at all. When the third wave of immigration, the Slavo-Latin wave, rolled over America, an original and quite distinct civilization had already developed there based on the principles evolved in the 17th and 18th centuries and applied in 19th century conditions of development. The German, Irish and Jewish contributions had left their mark on the original English foundation, whilst a Catholic element had developed side by side with the original Protestant stock. We can still recall, though today only as a fading memory, some of the representative types since become legendary of that period. First of all, there was Uncle Sam himself, popularized everywhere in cartoons, with his white goatee beard, his striped trousers, and his blue waistcoat spangled with stars. And then there was the famous American Uncle, who had gone off to the States, with a few coppers in his pocket to make a vast fortune, which he then left to his astonished heirs in the old country. There was also the captain of industry and the business mogul. Something of a buccaneer he was, floating railway and mining companies, speculating unscrupulously and vacillating between gigantic bankruptcies and prodigious success. And then there was the Irish boss, of whom there are, incidentally, a few examples left even in our own day, and the 400 of Fifth Avenue and Newport, of whom our 200 families represent a very pale reflection. The aristocracy of New England, people like Henry Adams, were a sort of American English, cultivated, refined, and already rich, with a wealth inherited from their parents. I think Henry Adams is the brother of Brooks Adams, who I talk about in Prophets of Doom, incidentally, who descended from John Adams, the original, one of the original presidents. Henry Adams was a sort of American English, cultivated, refined, already rich, with a wealth inherited from their parents, living the comfortable, to us, luxurious life of men and women who have never had to bother their heads about money. The quote-unquote beautiful American of 1900, very different from the still beautiful American of our day, was much grander and more important. She took up far more space with the immense hats of the period. She made us think of some great actress or other in the grand style. English, Irish, and Dutch types were more frequently met with back then, and except in the South, the Negroes were less visible. And there were fewer Mediterranean and Balkan types, and fewer Dagos of all kinds. It struck one as being physically a different race from the Americans of today. And in fact, it was. There was also a different conception of life, founded on individual enterprise, and the government did not dream of interfering in the lives of its citizens except to punish crime and to put down horse thieving. The result was a certain confusion, the background to frantic speculation and adventure, and the frontier was still open to the West, offering unlimited possibilities to anyone who was determined to make his way in life. "Go West, young man," was the extortion fired at any young fellow who girded against social constraint. The American of that era had a taste for the outlandish, which has since died out. The Englishman of Jules Verne was always represented as an energetic character, but supremely solid, whilst his American was something of an eccentric, prepared to risk everything, a builder certainly, but a little harebrained. This civilization expressed itself before the steamroller of standardization flattened it, in a series of local cultures, specific and geographically determined. They still existed in my time, and I got to know a number of them. Boston and New England were basically intellectual and Puritan. Baltimore and New Orleans were marked by a certain subtlety and refinement, still evident, though growing a trifle musty, inherited from the Old South before the days of the American Civil War. Philadelphia had its Quakers and upheld the tradition of the fathers of the Constitution. San Francisco was a Latin town, imbued with French and Mediterranean influences, and these were styles of cookery. There were styles of cookery and specialities to match all these local cultures, of which Baltimore clam soup and Virginia ham were perhaps the most original and most typically national. Cookery in Louisiana was Creole. In San Francisco, it was Italian and French, and represented by Chez Jules, pronounced Jules, of course, and Poodle Dog. The Poodle Dog. What's that? What's the Poodle Dog then? I have no idea. I've never been to San Francisco, one of the cities I've never been to. My missus has been there back when she was working. Anyway, American literature was more national too. Writers like Mark Twain, Walt Whitman, and Edgar Allan Poe were typical Americans, but so were Emerson, William James Thoreau, and Mrs. Alcott. But they were citizens of an America that no longer exists today. And I am sure they were all of British descent. The link with the European source was still unbroken. The humanism of a Lincoln, though profoundly of his country and his continent, is very near to us. We have no difficulty whatsoever in appreciating it. The factor which made this America unrecognizable in that which was to follow was the third wave of immigration de-Anglicized the country. One can now conceive of an America which, while remaining authentically American, would no longer be exclusively or even mainly Anglo-Saxon and Protestant. The geographic shift in the Anglo-Saxon centre of gravity in America is too obvious to escape notice. It was once in New England and Boston. It was once in New England, and Boston represented the hearth of a tradition which had remained English. Today, owing to mass immigration, that old Geneva of the old world, of the new world, has become an Irish Catholic town. There are, of course, still old Protestant families which dominate the social and financial life of the place. But in Boston today, the two most important personalities are the Catholic Archbishop and the Irish Catholic Mayor. I wonder what's happened to the demographics of Boston. I wonder if they've had even subsequent waves of mass immigration since. Does this mean that the Anglo-Saxon spirit, which was formerly at home in Boston, had ceased to exist? Not at all, but to some extent it had migrated from the centre to the west, to the new towns which have been founded there in the past 100 years. When we go beyond the Alleghenies, I don't know what that is. When we go beyond the Alleghenies, even beyond Chicago, it is easy to see that in these new communities, is that a mountain range then? What is Alleghenny? I've never seen that word. Alleghenny. What is that? Alleghenny. Alleghenies. What is that? The western part of the Appalachian Mountains. It refers to the Allegheny Mountains. The Alleghenies. The Alleghenies. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Well, you learn something new every day, folks, don't you? Okay. When we go beyond the Alleghenies, even beyond Chicago, it is easy to see that in these new communities, the leading elite is made up of some men who have come, or whose parents have come from the East, from Massachusetts. Massachusetts or Virginia. Long-time viewers will know I have never been able to say Massachusetts. So they come from there or Virginia. And in coming, they have brought with them those quantities which would make the grandeur of the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries. It is through these men that the old tradition is maintained under new skies. There is an unbroken line which allows us to trace the course of the same current of inspiration from the outset down to the present day. But we are compelled to recognize that the personnel has changed. Thus we now see, as the directing type of man of the Middle West, very sure of himself, a trifle pedantic, and on the whole rather German in his stolidity, his organizational gift, and his love of system. The proportion of the 100% descendants of English and Puritan stock has remained high amongst the people who matter, as an analysis of the people listed in Who's Who reveals. Side by side with them, there are now many people whose origin is Jewish, Latin, or Slav. And that is something quite new. It is not only in the streets of New York that the foreign element is prominent. Names ending in ski, rich, and eeny were practically unknown at one time amongst men holding prominent positions, but today they are no longer unusual, particularly not when politics have anything to do with the nomination. literature in America also reflects the intrusion of a completely new block of humanity, magnificently gifted, no doubt, but no longer restricted to the relatively narrow English and Protestant tradition. A literary period of the highest standard has recently opened up in America, but it is not possible to pretend that its character has remained exclusively Anglo-Saxon. But important as is the transformation which has taken place as a result of this change in personnel, infinitely more important, it appears to me, is the transformation, let us say a revolution, resulting from the new conditions of production and technique in general. Since the First World War, a new material life has come about, and the United States was indisputably its progenitor. Collective mechanical equipment based on the machine, mass production, serial production, has penetrated everywhere. It has been triumphant everywhere and transformed everything. Its effects have been proved irresistible and inexorable, and they have been exercised not only on industrial equipment, but on the equipment of everyday life, on the household, at the same time as on the world of communications, which includes the newspapers, magazines, books, education, religion, leisure and propaganda, even politics itself. Nothing escapes, nothing can escape. It is like an insidious penetration of damp in a wall, which has no damp course. And the consequence is that American civilization has not merely changed its inspiration and its character, but its epoch as well. The epoch of the pioneer has been replaced by the epoch of the machine. The former was inspired, above all, by individualist principles, individual enterprise, the responsibility of the individual conscience, the acceptance of a life perhaps hard, and the renunciation, a renunciation, almost ascetic, of, and the renunciation, almost aesthetic. Dash. All of these were Puritan ideas. Today, the conquest of the American continent has been completed. The frontier no longer exists in the West. That is, there is no longer any territories which are still open to settlement. The old notion of the quote-unquote West, a mystical notion incidentally, is still employed, but it no longer has any real sense now that the frontier is on the Pacific coast. The New Age is a mechanical age based on collective organization. In such conditions, the impression conveyed by American life in the 20th century is that of an immense structure which is becoming more and more anonymous, in which the commonest individual type is the employee. Perhaps the word which most frequently occurs in conversation is job, and that means merely employment. Everyone has a job, or is looking for a job, or is afraid of losing his job. What does Donald Trump say? Jobs, jobs, jobs. Since the economic crisis of 1929, the thought of losing one's job has become almost an obsession. There is no doubt whatever that there has been a tremendous progress in living standards, but this record standard of life now involves collective rather than individual effort, discipline, and a monstrous bureaucratic organization, which the enterprise and imagination of former days have become increasingly hampered, if not made impossible altogether. Jefferson, and remember, he's writing in 1952, Jefferson would no longer find the liberal environment in which he developed his ideology, nor Lincoln the environment in which, in the healthy atmosphere of the West, his humanism was born. The machine has passed that way, and nowhere in the world, not even in Russia, has it turned up the earth more thoroughly. America is going through the equivalent of a crisis of growth. The original traits of her youth still persist, but they are gradually being replaced by new traits which do not derive from her youth, because the technical revolution is proceeding more rapidly than the adaptation of her traditional outlook to the new conditions. There is a lack of sympathy between the ideology of the fathers of the Constitution and the assembly lines of Ford. It is obvious that it is very difficult to speak of an American psychology in the singular at a time when America, having had once had an individuality has since lost it and is now in the process of forming another one. In this crisis brought about by the clash of yesterday's ideas with today's methods, the problem is rather to know where to place the centre of moral gravity of a nation. What is the most representative type amongst Americans today? Is it still the Puritan? Is it the businessman, the politician, or, new departure indeed, the soldier? And which is the most important town in the United States? Is it New York, Boston, Chicago, Houston, or the new star, Los Angeles, a town I knew when it only had 90,000 inhabitants? What type can be taken as the average American? The Protestant of tradition, some Babbitt in the Middle West, a foreign newcomer on the Atlantic coast, or perhaps some more developed Negro from Harlem? In New York, I once saw a musical play written by a Jew, staged by an Armenian, and the principal actor was a Negro, and the composer of the music was a German. And yet the piece was authentically American, and the critics boasted of it as a national success. Many, many such cases, I'm sure. Obviously, the psychology of such a people must be looked at in a very special fashion. We've already noted the unity of behaviour amongst people of such disparate origins brought about by the standardisations of the country's general equipment. Despite the differences, one tends to see the same sort of thing everywhere. In Boston, New Orleans, Richmond, or San Francisco, everywhere there are the same trains, the same hotels, the same restaurants, the same petrol stations, the same newspapers, the same magazines, the same slogans, the same ideas. That uniformity, that monotony, has even become one of the bonds, not the least strong, of national unity. Strangely enough, it has not been suffered, but accepted, and even gladly accepted, as though it represented progress. This standardization strikes the visitor as having become the most significant characteristic of American society. However, we should not fail to recognize that the spirit which animates this mass continues to be fed from an anterior source. Even in these circumstances, we can still distinguish a guiding elite, the heirs of the moral tradition on the one hand, and a more passive mass on the other, which has accepted less the spirit than the material benefits of Americanism. Perhaps we ought to talk of castes rather than classes here, because there are no classes in the United States. Socially speaking, equality in the United States is complete, but ethnically, there is still a subtle barrier between the Anglo-Saxon of long standing in the country and the Slavo-Latin, whose family can look back on no more than 40 years' residence. Even the Irish Catholic, Al Smith, the governor of New York State, was beaten for the presidency in 1928, only because he was of Irish origin, and above all, because he was a Catholic. His social origin was humble, but it was not that which defeated him, but his membership of a certain caste. That is to say, to some extent, it was the kind of blood which ran through his veins. Here is another point which distinguishes America, democratic as she is, from our European democracies. And it is above all from this standpoint that we can distinguish the two psychologies in the United States corresponding to two different stages. The traits which characterize the governing strata are essentially active traits, and they thus seem mainly of Anglo-Saxon origin and Puritan Protestant background. Here we must turn back to the Puritan and the pioneer. We should note above all the presence of enterprise, and with it efficiency, virtues which result from conscience, a respect for effort, and the absence of routine. And then let us add confidence, confidence in man, confidence in the American man, in the American continent, in the United States, in the American Constitution, handed down like a sacred heritage from America's great forefathers. The Puritan of the 17th century believed in original sin, but he turned that pessimistic doctrine to good account and developed it into an instrument of great efficiency. Having become a disciple of Rousseau to an extent which we do not sufficiently realize, he has become that man. He has come to believe that man is naturally good and therefore deserves confidence. Goodwill is specifically American. It forms the basis of his civic sense, which is above all a very Protestant sense of social service. According to the tradition of a certain kind of Protestantism, such service embraces the duty and desire to evangelize, the urge to judge, to separate the sheep from the goats, and to lay down the law. In America, eloquence easily develops into sermonizing. A man like President Wilson delivered sermons as much as speeches. From the height of her moral rectitude, America is full of good counsels for the rest of us. Humility, incidentally, is a Catholic virtue. It is quite difficult to decide the hierarchy of values in America, because although the values may be material, they are classified in the spirit of idealism. The American is an apostle, but one who speaks in terms of dollars about things of the spirit. He is a believer, but one who believes that everything can be organized, including the things of the spirit. He is sincerely imbued with the dignity of man, but he believes that this dignity is inseparable from his standard of living. We are very far removed from Pascal here, who believed that it resided in man's thought. The American gospel is thus a social one, and it cannot be conceived without an effort to ameliorate the material conditions of man's life. At the same time, the American conceives it his duty to carry that gospel all over the world. His weapons are the Bible, the Frigidaire, and democracy on the Western model. His goodwill is sincere, his good faith beyond all question. It would be equally wrong to claim that he is either an idealist or a materialist. He is both at one and the same time, and in conditions which may seem contradictory to us, but which are not so for him. The New York Economic Council, Incorporated, came to the following conclusions in a report dated 4th of October, 1935. This is from that report. We excel in the spiritual domain. Statistics show that in 1933, which was a year of crisis, $3 billion was spent in the United States on education, which is more than was similarly spent in all other countries put together. We have invested more than $11 billion in educational institutes, both public and private. Our investments in the churches exceed $4 billion. Social devotion expressed in material achievements is typical of American Protestantism. Its good works are magnificent, but hardly any pace has been reserved for the contemplative side of life. The prestige of the professor, who merely teaches, pales before that of the president, who raises funds with which to equip the university. America has unquestionably been built by leaders whose psychology is more or less what we have described. But the mass of Americans have, on the whole, developed very differently. The main reason for this lies in the different conditions of their development. The newcomers, by immigration, have been integrated into a social structure which they had no hand in erecting and which was not erected for them. They had to let themselves be integrated in it because there was no alternative, and they agreed to it willingly enough because it was the very proof of their assimilation. But the virtues which are required now are not the virtues of the pioneer, instead of individual initiative. The call now is for industry, endurance, and discipline. It is becoming more and more difficult for a man to make his way in an environment which is no longer rural but urban, particularly because, in general, labour has ceased to be individual and it has become collective. More than elsewhere, society in America is a mass society, and it is in this very mass that its economic strength lies. In these circumstances, by contrast with what we have said a little while back, the average American conveys an impression of indefinable passivity, as though he lacked an active civic sense. And this is curiously something that Evola has talked about as well in his essays on America. His chief object is to find himself a job. The Irish, when they captured the municipalities, first encouraged this mentality. But since then, what with the New Deal, the Fair Deal, and the welfare state, it has become general until today. It is less a question of placing oneself in the service of the community than of making sure that one shares in its subventions. For the rest, the mass of Americans, even when they are demagogic, remain fundamentally disciplined. They are anxious for jobs. They are not revolutionaries. They respect and love the American system. Under a deceptive appearance, quite superficial, of free and easiness and even disorder, they are really one of the most docile and obedient of crowds ever to be met anywhere. Now, this discipline is not solely a matter of their work. It also applies to the conduct of their private lives and even to the sphere of ideas. The American has a sincere respect for anything educational. He believes in education, but he likes it to be practical. He regards it less as the acquisition of culture than as a collection of practical recipes. He prefers ready-made education, science out of the tin, and if possible, compressed science. He wants facile notions which he can take easily like a pill, notions which are readily applicable and painless to use. In the name of competence, he is prepared to accept anything from the hands of an expert, and there are, incidentally, many really first-class experts in the United States. Hence the curious and unexpected conformism of this people, who were imaginative and even a trifle erratic only yesterday. As far as the immigrant is concerned, this very conformism was the sign of his assimilation, that is to say, the sign of his full adaptation into the great American family. American opinion has become hostile to anyone who is different from the rest, and this conformist element is something that many, many other European writers I've read have picked up on. I actually think that this is crept, this conformist element has crept into all other countries as well as part of the revolution of mass and scale. You know, I'm thinking of like the experience of going to a theme park, you know, which is extremely passive, kind of consumer experience, distinctly American, but also you can do that basically in any Western country now. Far from suffering at the thought of being exactly like everyone else, the American flatters himself on it and is quite content to wear the same hat, to adopt the same attitude, and to express the same ideas as everyone else. It has remained the fashion to boast of individuality, but if it takes the form of originality, of protest against the slogans everyone else accepts, it can make a man's life difficult and his personal success improbable. You know, this is the whole idea of I'm an individual, but I'm going to rebel in exactly the same way as everyone else. You know, funny, yesterday I did a Twitter post where I said that, and then I posted a video of AC/DC's Thunderstruck, which has got a crowd that are all wearing the same t-shirt, all kind of dancing in the same way. I said, look, this is the state in the art of rebellion. You know, this video has been watched by 1.6 billion people, all individuals, all rebelling in exactly the same way. Right? And there is a distinct, it is at once, quote unquote, individualistic, but also deeply conformist, right? It's a kind of, this kind of empty rebellion in a way, which is distinctly American, I think. Even though, of course, that band I mentioned isn't necessarily American. It has remained the fashion to boast of individuality, but if it takes the form of originality, of protest against the slogans everyone else accepts, it can make a man's life difficult and his personal success impossible. It is not difficult to realize that this attitude can be very dangerous. I am also inclined to believe that this tendency to conformism will prove one of the future dangers for American civilization. The American reacts excellently to publicity. At least those who manipulate it tell us that it does, that he does. Propaganda is a singular efficiency where he is concerned. So I'll read that again. Propaganda is of singular efficiency where the American is concerned, is what he means. And this has important political consequences because by the usual tried and trusted methods, the government is in a position to carry public opinion with it. Economically, this collective discipline favors standardization of production and allows the manufacture of commodities to be canalized into a powerful series. The customer, dutiful and also prudent, does not protest because it works out to his advantage. Politically, the wireless broadcast offers the orator the means of getting into direct touch with millions of electors. It is less an affair of wealth, we know for instance that Wall Street did not get the better of Truman, than of organization and an irresistible technique of spreading the arguments which convince. The thing that fares worse in this system is the critical spirit, as soon as it bows obediently into the competence of the expert. Technique, a new and youthful divinity, is victorious over culture, a goddess in decline. The immigrants who came to America had a tradition of centuries behind them. America rejuvenated them and turned them into adolescents and carried away by the impetus, even into children. And in fact, one often has the impression of puerility in dealing with these neo-Americans, so proud of the instruments of thought that they almost forgot thought itself. Of course, we understand their gratitude to a country which has given them the dignity of labor and a degree of political liberty with which, with my eyes shut tight, I should be ready to content myself. Remaining optimists, they still believe that under this regime, everyone has a chance of becoming a millionaire or the president of the republic. Even if that is no longer true, it is important to note that most Americans still believe it. I am led to the conclusion that at the present time, the United States is in full enjoyment of all its possibilities. The country still retains the full dynamism of the 19th century, and at the same time has gained all the efficiency of the 20th century. The Second World War showed beyond dispute that the American people are capable of creative imagination and organization. Adapting themselves to entirely new conditions, they demonstrated clearly that they were capable of waging war without routine and without rigidity. They created armies in accordance with the exigencies of a situation without historical precedent, whether it was a question of transport, administration, or the movement of masses of men. It required almost contradictory qualities in which suppleness coincided with method, perhaps a unique juxtaposition in which the elan of the individualist age still animated the already developed structure of the mechanical age. The greatest danger may still be in the future when the organization finally gets the upper hand of the individual. Already we can see the divorce between the ideology of the 18th century, which it is still the fashion to praise, and the collective structure of the mechanical age, which the 20th century still insidiously is imposing more and more every day. Man often believes that he is leading then when he is being led. And whilst his spirit urges him towards one aim, his heart insensibly draws him towards another. This maxim of La Rochefoucauld, simply transposed, applies exactly to American psychology, because it is now at the parting of ways. In a striking article published in Foreign Affairs in July 1949, Gerald Tanqueray Robinson closely analysed the ideological combat, as he calls it, which is still at present taking place in the respect in the United States. The country, he declares, is approaching the crisis of 1949 with the military equipment of 1950, but with the ideology of 1775. There is a conflict between the testament of the fathers of the Constitution and the methods which are being more and more adopted in American practice. The individualist and liberal ideology of tradition is no longer in accordance with the exigencies of a society almost now totally industrialized. In the 19th century, a very large proportion of the American people were in a position to have a real say in their day-to-day activity. Pioneers, tillers of the soil, producers who had not yet been swallowed up by the trusts, took good care to see that the state did not intrude into their private lives, and they did not dream of asking the state to take over new obligations. Democracy signified individualism and decentralization. In the 20th century, on the other hand, mechanized industry tends to demand that men should work in masses under a collective discipline in undertakings growing larger and larger, and the rhythm of the worker is regulated more and more by that of the machine. Reduced to impotence, the individual feels prompted to have a recourse to the state, even at the price of accepting its social discipline. And the result is the New Deal, the Fair Deal, the welfare state. In an impressive argument, Tanqueray Robinson suggests that technology is the mother of the large-scale undertaking and the grandmother of state intervention, and that, disquieting parallelism, the pursuit of efficiency leads down the same collective slope in Pittsburgh as in Magnitogorsk, which is probably in Russia somewhere. America has had no cause to complain of this regime, which has evolved a standard of life higher than ever before, together with a shorter working day. But the price she has paid for these advantages has been the disappearance of millions of individual farmers and artisans. Once independent, they have become disciplined servants of the machine. In the meantime, the official ideology remains what it was 150 years ago. Individualism, private enterprise, liberty, and free competition. And in perfectly good faith, the American sincerely remains attached to it. But, as the moralists point out, whilst his spirit urges him towards one aim, the whole tendency of the age insensibly draws him towards another. Here, beyond question, is the real American problem. And at the same time, it is a problem for the West as a whole. So there we go. Very interesting from Siegfried. I was also interested that, like, he doesn't always get into questions of race and ethnicity, but he felt compelled to when he was discussing the Americans. So, I mean, it's just an indisputable fact of their history that you have these three large waves of immigration. And obviously now there's been an even, probably been a fourth and a fifth large wave as well, hasn't there? Anyway, really fascinating. I'm glad we're finishing. I was, you know, as the ratings were going down for this, I was thinking of pulling the plug, but the viewers rallied, the people were like, no, you must finish this. So I'm glad that I did. Pick up a course, of course, the Trivium, and I'll be back tomorrow for office hours. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.